Good morning. Welcome to Senate Finance. Today is Thursday, February 1st, 2018. The time is 9:03 a.m. If you're joining us off-net or online, we're in the Senate Finance Room in Juneau, Alaska, on the fifth floor. I'm Co-Chairman Anna McKinnon. With me this morning, Co-Chairman Hoffman.
Good morning.
Vice Chairman Bishop.
Good morning.
Senator Von Imhoff.
Good morning.
Senator Rolson.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
Senator Stevens. And we should be joined shortly by Senator Machicki, who is away on other state business at this time. Anything to come before the committee before we begin? Seeing none, we are continuing a conversation, and we have the support of a PowerPoint that is online in Senate Finance. It is labeled Senate Finance Committee Medicaid Cost Drivers and Reform Update. It's dated January 31st, 2018. We concluded on slide 13 yesterday and are continuing the conversation about Medicaid and the cost drivers of Medicaid and reform effort by the state of Alaska. I'd like to invite presenters Monique Martin, if Margaret Brody is here, if she would like to join us at the microphone also, Shauna O'Brien or John Sherwood, whoever the department would like to bring to the microphones this morning. I'd like to first thank Senate Finance staff for working, and my office for working with the monitor issue. Ms. Brody, I couldn't see you yesterday, or I was having a challenge being able to see you, and so they've tried to lower that screen so that you can have good eye contact with the committee members. Welcome to Senate Finance. If you could identify yourself for the record, again, we have multiple female voices on the microphones today. So while we may be able to recognize a response from Deputy Commissioner Sherwood differently than the others, if you could identify yourself for those that might not have a visual, and so that the secretaries can follow and record appropriately who's speaking today.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Monique Martin. I'm a healthcare policy advisor at the Department of Health and Social Services. And we'll dive right into where we left off yesterday on slide 14 for those following at home on primary care case management. This was a portion of SB 74 that required the department to provide some care management services for those Alaskans who are receiving Medicaid and have multiple hospitalizations. And what we did, because ultimately we hope that these Alaskans can shift to a coordinated care demonstration project as those ramp up, or to receive services through the 1115 behavioral health waiver. We ramped up the AMCCI, the Alaska Medicaid Coordinated Care Initiative, to provide care management services for those of individuals. And we talked about this one a little bit yesterday, but I just thought we would might help kind of catch us back up, at least me as a presenter, warm back up again. And we've had great success with this program. AMCCI and the contractors help us a little bit with some other programs. And we're looking at AMCCI providing perhaps some services for those re-entering communities from the correctional system. And as you can see, this allowed us to sort of skip that administrative process of ramping up a new program in the state. And by using that contractor, we were able to exceed those savings by quite a bit in FY17 and feel confident that we can achieve the savings in FY18 and hopefully exceed them as much as we did this current or this past fiscal year. Moving to slide 15 on telehealth, SB 74 outlined some pretty significant requirements for telehealth. And currently, we do allow Medicaid providers to bill for telehealth services. On this one, in that green chart at the top, we listed the savings as indeterminate, and at least initially, as we ramp up some of the telehealth work group. The department convened a stakeholder work group. Through our Medicaid redesign listserv, we solicited providers to participate and had a great turnout for this and a couple other work groups, including one that closes today for innovative payment models. And I've provided the link for those at home who might want to dive into the 10 recommendations that the telehealth work group provided to the department. Not all of those fall into the purview of the Department of Health and Social Services, but we're looking at how we might be able to continue this work group into the future and connect them with the folks that can help with some of the legal hurdles at the federal level, some of the funding sources that they identified as potential barriers that they receive from the federal government, and how do we help ensure those funding sources continue into future years. As noted here at the bottom bullet, the SB 74 was very specific that any telehealth programs that we implement would also help reduce the Medicaid costs. And we want to be very conscientious of that before opening the doors too wide for telehealth and actually having the opposite effect on the Medicaid budget. So we're doing a financial analysis of those and looking at perhaps narrowing the scope a little bit or reconvening those stakeholders to help us really see how we can achieve savings through telehealth. But as a reminder, we do allow providers to bill Medicaid for telehealth right now, and we will be able to expand those savings as we implement some of these recommendations. Moving forward to slide 16, health homes is a very specific definition in the Affordable Care Act. Depending on which section you're looking at, you might hear it as 2703 or 1945 health homes. We have been planning for health homes, and getting back to the coordinated care demonstration projects that we talked about yesterday, again, it's difficult to be too specific because they are part of an ongoing RFP negotiation process. But we do believe that one of our coordinated care demonstration projects will be a good model for other parts of the state and other providers to implement. We don't necessarily want to ramp up the health home in Alaska because we do get a 90-10 match. So instead of our typical 50-50 state match or the enhanced match for CHIP, we get a 90-10. So the federal government will pay 90% of the costs associated with implementation of a health home model, but only for 8 quarters. So we want to be conscientious that when we implement that, that we can implement it as far across the state as we can to maximize those savings instead of for just a smaller group of Medicaid recipients in just one part of the state. We want to maximize those opportunities.
Madam Chair.
Senator Stevens.
Could we have a better explanation of what health home means, of what it does?
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, health homes allow providers to do things a little bit differently. I think when we've talked to our counterparts in the state of Oregon, one of the examples they gave is an elderly woman living in the eastern part of their state did not fare well in the hot heat of summer months. And she often presented at emergency rooms because it exacerbated her health conditions. And what the health home was able to do is they realized that this woman was just getting overstressed from heat. And what they bought was a window air conditioner for $200, and she put it in her bedroom, and her emergency room visits plummeted, literally almost overnight, when the air conditioning unit was plugged in. So it really allows providers to look at the person's, not just their physical health, but what are their living conditions that might be affecting their health care conditions. It also, which is very important for our 1115 waiver, looks at treating behavioral health and physical health in the same location and really having providers work together to make sure that we're addressing both behavioral health and how's that affecting physical health and vice versa.
Senator Stevens, follow up.
Moving to slide 17, this is an initiative in SB 74 to require the Pioneer Homes to have residents apply for Medicaid to show that they've applied, whether they've been denied or are eligible. That would be a requirement before receiving any other payment assistance through the Pioneer Homes. So the Pioneer Homes have been implementing this initiative quite directly with residents. The challenge has been, as you can see, we were off track in 2017. We do feel like we are going to be delayed for 18, and there's a couple reasons for that that we're trying to address. Is one, residents that would meet the level of care for to qualify for the waivers for to be eligible for Medicaid are our most frail residents at the Pioneer Homes. There is quite a few of them that who don't qualify for Medicaid initially that we would perhaps need to work with them and their family member to set up some income qualifying trusts. There's also the waiver applications to show the level of need. And that though because these are our most frail residents at the Pioneer Homes, they tend to pass away before we can get through that full process. Also, level three is probably where we've seen some of the reductions in staff. Because these are our most frail residents, it's often a one-to-one staff ratio, so we've had to limit some of those numbers. But the Pioneer Homes are looking at more opportunities to expand those services and do some different waiver services and working with opportunities to expand and open those beds back up. And then that will allow us to serve more Alaskans through the waiver and get an enhanced federal match for those residents. Moving to slide.
We have a question. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Martin, I guess as you look at the process for trying to get the waivers, is there any chance of trying to speed that up so they can take advantage of it before they pass away? And hopefully the state will go ahead and benefit from that as well.
Through the chair, Senator Olson, yes, that's something that the Pioneer Homes is working with the Division of Public Assistance and with Seniors and Disability Services to make sure that how can we speed up that process? What are our opportunities for efficiencies in that process when this has been specifically directed to the department by the legislature through SB 74? Director Lofgren from the Pioneer Homes could potentially speak to this more if you would like additional information.
Actually, Madam Chair, if I could continue.
Please, Senator.
My question has to do with what can we do here in the legislature, the Finance Committee in particular, that would go ahead and make this a more efficient process so it's not so agonizing to the department as well as the patient.
Through the chair, Senator Olson, I think we've identified some of our internal barriers, but perhaps Deputy Commissioner Sherwood could speak to those issues.
With all due respect, Deputy Mr. Sherwood, I guess one thing that bothers me and one thing that I see, especially with older people in my district, is the bureaucracy that they've got to go through and the not understanding what the benefit is in the end that causes the frustration with these families that are out there and their loved one in particular. And we seem to be standing in the way.
Thank you, Senator Olson. Deputy Commissioner Sherwood.
For the record, my name is John Sherwood. I'm Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Health and Social Services. And through the chair, Senator Olson, we're certainly looking at how to address the barriers. Unfortunately, most of the barriers that occur are the result of federal requirements. For people in long-term care, they are subject to transfer of asset penalties. So even though somebody may not have had assets, we still have to look back 5 years at their financial records to assure that there are no transfer of assets that would make them ineligible. With the waiver process itself, we can't approve somebody and then retroactively go back and pay for services provided before that approval. That's part of the rules. Certainly, we do what we can to make sure that when somebody is a candidate, we can get the assessment done so that we can get that process moving. But it is often a somewhat slow process to move through both the eligibility determination that's done by the Division of Public Assistance and through the assessment process done by Senior and Disability Services. I think there's a pretty good coordination between the two. Can we do better? Yes, in terms of what can be done at the legislative level, I don't really see much. One of the things we've considered is perhaps locating one of the long-term eligibility workers within the Division of Senior and Disability Services so we can sort of troubleshoot when things aren't moving faster. And I our divisions are working that out, you know, as we speak. But I really do appreciate the concern, because I mean, it's one we share.
No further questions, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Deputy Commissioner Sherwood. Thank you, Senator Olson. I want to welcome Senator Michiki. Senator Michiki, we did notify the public that you were on other state business this morning.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I will review the previous conversation on the tape.
Thank you, Senator Michiki. We did a recap of slide 14, so there's just a few slides that that you haven't been privy to the conversation around. Please continue, Ms. Martin.
Thank you. Moving to slide 18, the Emergency Department Improvement Initiative is a partnership between the Alaska State Hospital and Nursing Home Association and the Alaska Chapter of Emergency Physicians. And one of the key parts of the Emergency Department Improvement Initiative is EDI, or ED, depending on who you talk to, which is the real-time information exchange for physicians and providers in emergency room facilities. 9 hospitals are currently live with this information exchange, and others are in various stage of ramp-up to bring the system on. And this really provides providers and hospitals in emergency rooms to look at, is a patient presenting, and this is regardless if they are a Medicaid patient, a self-pay, do they come with their own private insurance. They're able to look at, is this person presenting at multiple emergency rooms across the municipality of Anchorage seeking prescription painkillers inappropriately. It also helps us identify perhaps folks that aren't getting connected with a primary care provider to address their health concerns. So is there a reason that they keep continually coming back to an emergency room? And then we work to connect those individuals with primary care case managers or specialists to help address their conditions. And one of the things that they did recently is submit some regulations to be able to connect the emergency department information exchange, that real-time information exchange, with the prescription drug monitoring program, so they can see not only did someone present at another facility, but did they receive prescription drugs, or are they even receiving prescription drugs from a primary care provider or someone outside of the emergency room services across our state. And I provided for those at home a link to the Alaska State Hospital and Nursing Home Association page. They have some guidelines for prescribing prescription narcotics and other information that folks might find interesting.
Thank you. Senator Von Imhoff and I had a discussion earlier about emergency room. And so, Senator Von Imhoff.
So thank you, Madam Chair. So just looking at some of the previous slides, I remember slide 6, it shows that the hospital's costs are some of the biggest cost drivers. And then I remember, you know, yesterday we talked about coordinated care programs and primary care. And I think you mentioned at one point, you know, you'll call people, hey, you've got your appointment tomorrow and so forth. But I do know that looking at slide 6 with how many hospital stays, are you finding that, are you tracking people, patients who are using the hospital or the ER for non-ER use? And so do you track that data? And then when you talk to people and call them, kind of what you just described and said, you know, what is it that you're doing? Why are you using the ER a lot? Yet they sort of ignore you and continue to use the ER and the costs continue to go up. Is there any efforts to say, well, you know what, you've allotted your ER time and we're done with this. We're not going to pay for it anymore.
Through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, we have a couple of programs that are underway, and we include some data in the annual report that we'd be happy to provide in writing on some of those numbers, as well as some of the work at healthcare services. If it's agreeable to the chair, Director Brody could provide some information on some of the other programs that we have to identify and make sure folks try and help them reduce their utilization of the emergency room.
Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you. Yes, I would like to see data that you've collected in the past that shows who you've identified high utilizers, and then what you've done to try to decrease the utilization, because it definitely looks like in the slides that hospital stays continue to be a very high cost driver. So I'll be curious to see, you know, what efforts have been done in that area. And when you do utilize the data, do you somehow flag that as high importance because it is the highest cost driver at this point? And again, do you, as any of your programs, do you stop coverage after a certain amount of time?
Director Brody.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Margaret Brody. I'm the Director of Healthcare Services. So if an individual is overutilizing the services, we have a program called Service Utilization Reviews. And so we do go through, and this is both for recipients and providers. So if a provider is over-prescribing or an individual is overutilizing services, they are identified each and every month. And if they don't work through our care management program, if they continue with the behaviors that they had before using the emergency room, then they're put in a what's called a care management program, and it's a lock-in program. And so they are locked into one physician and one pharmacy. And if they utilize the emergency room, Medicaid does not pay for that unless it was an emergency.
Care management program. Okay. I'll get granular. Thank you. I'll get granular offline. Thank you.
Senator Bishop.
I got a granular question. What is the leading cause of return visits to the ER?
This is Margaret Brody, through the chair. The leading cause is typically individuals with behavioral health issues.
Thank you.
Director Brody, Alaskans are very interested in this topic of overutilization of hospitals that is amplified in this particular initiative, and there are other initiatives that are happening in the department in regards to care coordination. And so could you speak to us why care coordination may not be the entry point of determining whether someone should be on in the CMP program, which would restrict use and that we could follow the usage of the benefits more closely?
Madam Chair, we actually have both programs going on at all times, and they actually make referrals between each other. Our contractor who does the care management program right now has 312 individuals enrolled in the program, and it's a matter of what they are able to manage. They can only manage just over 300 people in the care management program at any time.
So we have a limitation on how many they can manage. I received an email from a constituent that asked me to ask you why the Division of Healthcare Services has decided not to maximize the return on investment with the care management program by targeting a structured delivery of the services for those that are, I believe, in what I'm reading, for overutilization of the hospital and the ER.
Madam Chair, it's been the capacity of our contractor, and we realize that shortcoming. And so beginning in June of this year, we've already signed the contract and are in the process of ramping up, where Truven Analytics will be taking over our care management program, and we'll be able to serve many more recipients through that program.
Director Brody, does that mean that you will start to look specifically as a number one cost driver inside of the system, overutilization of emergency room for regular care, and that will be the starting point to see where we will drive individuals for care so that we can start defining their access if they have not been able to define it for themselves?
Madam Chair, we use data analytics to determine who's an outlier of the use of services. And they have to be a mean outside of the rest of the population. In other words, they have to stand out, because the individuals also have rights, and they can go to a fair hearing and state that being placed in the care management program is not appropriate for them. They don't overutilize services. So it's where we set the bar of the overutilization of the services. And using this new contractor, one will be able to serve a lot more recipients, and we're going to be able to change that bar as we need it. So as we see services being overutilized for one reason or another, we're going to be able to bring them into the program a lot quicker.
I appreciate that, and it seems like best practice to do so. But if ER visits are the number one cost driver per dollar, then shouldn't that be the entry-level criteria when we start to make some determinations on the level the bar should be set at? So as an example, if I overutilize based on the initiative that you've spoken to on slide 18, we definitely have an opioid epidemic going in our state. And we want to track those things, and it's of great value for the health of our community to make sure that we do that. But if that initiative that may be a lower dollar cost item is first in the queue versus the higher cost payments for the state's financial system, and that is balanced with health, how are you determining which should be first? And from at least one perspective that I've had feedback on from yesterday's conversation, and I believe the Finance Committee has received that email as well, or other members beside myself, it's being asserted that if we would, from a financial perspective, place the hospitals as the first criteria, that we would be able to control costs much better under the managed care concept for the state. And I understand the department is balancing that with individual freedom of choice to be able to access facilities. But is there a pushback from the department that the highest cost drivers should not be first in line for the criteria?
Madam Chair, this is still Margaret Brody. Yes, we do look at the highest cost drivers. For example, with opioids, they could be drug-seeking at the different emergency rooms, and that's not an appropriate visit. Or there could be an overdose, and that is an emergency visit, and that is something that we would pay for. So we do look at the highest cost and try to get those people enrolled in the care management program. The thing that has stopped us the most is literally just the number of individuals that our contractor is able to serve. 2 years ago, we tried to change the contract for them to serve 1,000 people, and they were unable to do that, and that's why we're changing contractors now.
Director Brody, I appreciate that. I'll yield. Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So you mentioned Truven. Truven is analytics is who you're going to go with in June?
Through the chair, yes, Senator. Okay. I'm left.
Very pleased to hear that. They're reputable. They've done work for many other states. I do hope that when you begin the contract that you can get data quickly and that you provide them, that you're capable of providing them diagnostic data so they can start running analysis immediately. And I suspect that within a year, within 6 months, based on the research that I've done on that particular company, and I've looked and seen the reports that they can spit out, I believe that you ought to be able to have a significant illumination on the contributing factors of population behavior. And then I hope to see then this time next year a report and then a prioritization of allocation of resources, not new resources, but a prioritization of resources based on the information that you find. So thank you for going with Truven, and I wish you luck with that.
Thank you.
Brief at ease.
No.
We're back on the record. Senate Finance, if you're still following. Director Brody, in all the time that we've been looking at Medicaid, or at least for the last few years, there has been a discussion surrounding major cost drivers in the Medicaid system, in healthcare reform in general. And first, I want to put on the record, if I've got it correctly, so that the general public can have confidence in the statement. We are looking at huge cost drivers for doctors, the actual care providers, pharmaceutical companies included in that, insurance and insurance providers, and hospitals. Is that accurate in a big way?
Madam Chair, it is accurate for hospitals, physicians, and pharmacies.
We don't think insurance is driving costs?
Madam Chair, insurance is maybe driving costs, health care costs overall, which impact the Medicaid program.
Thank you. And the reason why I ask that is, as we're studying different ideas and we look at some kind of limits on our program, should there be a higher weighted average on hospital stays? And so when we hear from constituents as elected officials, even when I go to my doctor, I won't say which doctor, but on their wall is the salaries for CEOs of insurance companies. So there are pointing of fingers depending on where I engage as an individual in an Alaskan market for healthcare. And so the doctors are saying that it costs a lot to work in Alaska and that malpractice insurance is high, and they have huge liabilities in trying to keep Alaskans healthy and enter and engage with individuals that may have very complex issues that are presenting at any given time. So doctors are doing, from their perspective, the best they can when someone walks in with the information provided that maybe one individual doesn't remember a lot of things that happened. So on the doctor's wall, at least one office has all of the costs or the salaries of the CEOs. So that doctor, from my opinion, is telling me when I enter that office that insurance companies are causing part of the problem. I'll just put it like that. They make a lot of money as far as their leadership goes. And then we have pharmaceuticals that we're talking about here and affecting the health of Alaskans during an opioid crisis, which loops us back to possibly doctors prescribing in that practice or illegal drugs on the street. But when we're studying these things, the other cost driver is hospital and hospital stays, and the things that are happening on an Alaskan's hospital bill that may be secondary to the physician's cost and the drugs. And so at least one constituent has raised the issue that should we, during the things that we are studying, study or weight the criteria under that limited access proposal, CMP, the CMP program, that as we study that, should we have hospitals, because of that cost driver, in a higher priority order or weighted differently as we are studying these things?
Madam Chair, this is Margaret Brody. For hospital stays, we actually have a contractor determine what the length of hospital stays should be and if they're appropriate. We use Qualys Health, who uses a nationally recognized data analytics program called InterQual. So depending on the condition that the person has and their overall health, their length of hospital stay is determined and prior approved. So somebody doesn't just go to the hospital and be there for 10 days and then Medicaid picks up the bill. All this, unless they're admitted from the emergency room, and then there's 3 days before they have to get that prior approval. But every single hospital stay is prior approved, and it meets this national criteria for the length of stay for the condition that they actually have.
Dr. Brody, that is a good best practice to use, and I appreciate that. But we were talking earlier about emergency stops at the weighted average and trying to manage folks' stay in the hospital, at least from my perspective, was directly linked to emergency room stays, where individuals that are on the system are using their emergency room privileges to access healthcare that's available in a doctor's office, basically. And so that was more the tone of, are we waiting in our studies to try to control the costs of this system based on the state and what the state and the federal government is paying for those stays?
Madam Chair, we were identifying those individuals on a quarterly basis, but under this new contract, it's going to be a better feed that includes everything about the individual to Truven Data Analytics. So we're going to be able to intervene quicker than we're able to intervene now. Right now, it could take 3 to 6 months before we're able to intervene just because of the cycle of the way things go. And that's another reason why we're trying this new way, because we think we're going to be able to intervene literally within a week of the stay.
Thank you. Further questions on slide 18? Senator Michicki.
Yeah, it's kind of a general, just looking at the list that was handed out of the cost per recipient per year of $11,000. Just looking at a couple of the categories, and they range from the age group of 1 through 12 at $5,100 a year to the age of 85 or older at $44,000 a year. These are actual utilization costs. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Senator Michicki, this is Margaret Brody. Yes, that is correct.
Okay. So, Madam Chair, if I may.
Senator Michicki, could you refer to the document so that if those are someone's trying to follow you at home where you're grabbing those numbers from, that was the document that was passed out yesterday, I believe, or was it included in a packet?
It was on our desk this morning. It's the Medicaid claims and enrollment state FY17 document.
Thank you.
So my question is, these seem much higher than sort of a non-Medicaid recipient costs on an annual basis, right? So we have insurance but may not have utilization. These are actual utilization costs, and they seem unreasonably high on a per capita basis for the different groups. My question is, have we considered an intense case management program for the top 25% of users? So these are the average costs on children 1 through 12 on Medicaid at $5,100. Of course, they're not one of the higher groups. One of the higher groups of the typically healthy ages is in the adult range of 55 through 64 at $18,000 a year. My question is, I normally don't support additional costs in state management. However, we're talking about a total of, you know, $2 billion in costs here. Have we thought about a program of intensive case management for those that are in the high-use categories, perhaps the top 25%, where savings of managing those cases could be in the hundreds of millions of dollars a year? And I bring it up on this slide because this is one of the key cost drivers. But is that something that we've considered as opposed to just not having a comprehensive plan to manage those higher utilization costs?
Through the chair, Senator Michicki, this is Margaret Brody again. Some of those individuals are in a case management type program. However, once you reach that age limit, those are the people that, for the most part, are becoming disabled and need a lot more assistance in their activities of daily living, or may even be institutionalized, and that's where the costs go up substantially.
Madam Chair, that's not related to my question. I'm sorry. I should state it in a different way. Let's scratch the 85 or older. Let's look at just a typical, normally healthy range of utilization. Let's pick a young adult. Let's pick 21 through 30. The average cost is $11,000 per year, $10,998. These are small, so I think that's what I read. $10,998. That is the average cost, which is an average cost that's much higher from my experience in the private sector of a non-Medicaid person. There's not the pressure in the Medicaid utilization that you have in the private sector to keep costs down. This is the average. Some are going to be much higher, some are going to be much lower. If we tried to manage the cases intensely of the top 25%, and if I were to draw these out for the top utilization of 25% in the $10,000, $11,000 range, that's probably going to be, you know, a $30,000, $40,000 utilization person. We could drive the cost down substantially by helping those individuals to manage their health care. I'm just wondering if that's something we're looking at. And for, I purposely did not mention the 85 or older. I understand that's where those costs are going to be very difficult to manage. I'm talking about the normally healthy other ranges of life. Is that something we're considering, or is that something we should consider in statute that will push the utilization management of those higher use individuals?
Through the chair, Senator Michiki, this is Margaret Brody. We believe that under our new contract, we will be picking up those very individuals that you're talking about. Right now, we're limited. We have the top 300 people, the most expensive 300 people, but we are looking at being able to serve several thousand people under this new contract, and we intend to pick up those high-cost individuals under this because they have the ability to serve more recipients than what we have right now, and that it will be fully online in June of this year. We had the kickoff meetings just last week working with the different divisions and working with our enterprise contractor to ensure that the data feeds that they need to do their work will be available.
Thank you. Michiki, follow up?
Yes, I will remain plugged into that intimately. And as Senator Von Imhoff was talking about, if there's a place I'm willing to spend money to save money, that's a place I'm willing to spend money to save money. I think the potential there, again, is in the hundreds of millions of dollars per year. So I'm very interested in the progress of that project.
Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you. So on the subject of spending money to save money, I understand that. Is the Traven cost of that contract in the 2019 budget?
Through the chair, Senator Imhoff, this is Margaret Brody again. The cost was taken away from the enterprise contract, and I believe I actually saved $200,000 a year with the new contract.
Well done.
Director Brody, is this a new idea that we've waited for, or just one we've finally gotten to that could actually help us differently? Because we've tried to, during the whole process of SB 74 in the conversation about improving our system, tried to prioritize efficiencies under the Medicaid program to go forward. Is there competing interests inside of Department of Health and Social Services to fix the highest cost drivers, or are other things diverting the department's attention? Because this seems like something that is apparent, and I'm wondering just how we are just now getting to moving more people onto the program.
Madam Chair, this is Margaret Brody. We've been wanting to change for a while. It comes down to the capacity of the staff to be able to take on more initiatives. And so for several years, our main focus was getting claims paid timely and accurately. And once we were able to move past that, then we were looking at what is it that we can change that will have benefit and will save a lot of money. So when we renewed the contract for the enterprise system, we specifically took out four lines of business for 2018 that we're actually taking away from that contractor. And it is a lot of work on the state's part to be able to do that. But within the Department of Health and Social Services, we are all working very closely together. We're all working on different projects at different times for Senate Bill 74, but we have it all lined out as to what needs to go in where, what work needs to be done when, so that the system is ready for each and every reform, and that we hopefully meet all our deadlines. So far, we're on track for everything. And we do have a monthly meeting of all the Medicaid directors, the deputy commissioners, the chief medical officer, and other important staff members in each division. And we talk over all these different things that are going on to see what do we have the capacity to be able to work with and do more things. One example that's been going on forever because of the capacity is we want to be able to give individuals an explanation of the benefits that they received. We want to be able to give them every single month, here's what the Medicaid program spent on you. And so we're working on that, but it keeps getting kicked down as we pull in things that are actually going to save money for the state. So we hopefully will see that this year. I think that's important. I think that that's going to go to some of these individuals that spend a lot of money. I don't think that they realize, because very little, they're just paying their co-pays, so they don't realize that, you know, okay, so they paid $10 and the state paid $15,000 for the same thing. They don't have that understanding because they don't receive that information. We do do that for a few people every single quarter. It's random. They just select individuals and send those explanation of benefits out. But I also don't believe that the recipients may understand what it is that we're sending them. So when we are able to send them to everybody, there'll also be a lot of education that goes along with that.
Two follow-ups. I believe I talked briefly about it yesterday, and I know that the Senate Finance Committee had an intense conversation about explanation of benefits during the SB 74 conversation from past years. So it is important for us to let the people know how much money we are providing as a state to help support individuals and families who are in need of health care. Can you speak to me about the organization, your organizational structure, in taking on initiatives inside of the Medicaid system? So your staff has been, your team, and I mean the overall team, has been very focused because we had a change in software that we are still in the process of trying to have certified, which we spoke about yesterday. And you provided us a historical timeline of the progress and the challenges to complete the certification. So now that the deployment on that particular challenge is being remediated and conquered as we move through the system, who was helping with that? Is that folks that personnel, PCNs that are directly in Medicaid, or is it the whole team at the Department of Health and Social Services that is being deployed to help with the system?
Madam Chair, this is Margaret Brody. It is a team within Healthcare Services that is responsible for the system. Our contractor, Conduent, actually codes the system and makes the changes at our systems team direction. And so we tell them what we need, and if it's a big enough project, we're able to get a 90% match from the federal government. So if it's big enough, we do that for anything that we can. Pretty much anything that's going to be over $100,000 right now, I am asking the federal government for a 90% match. Whereas in years past, and I mean before my time, we would just kind of sucked that up in the Medicaid budget. But now we're trying to get every federal dollar that we can for them. So we direct the contractor, here's the project that we need. Give us a time frame that it can be done. How much is it going to cost? How many deployments are there going to be for it? And so they outline the whole project, the cost for it, the number of people that they're going to require for it, and when the milestones, which are the deployments, are going to be met. And we might negotiate that a little bit back and forth, try to pull in the time frames, try to decrease the dollars that were charged. And then once we accept that, we do a contract amendment. And so they go forth. We have weekly meetings on every single project that is going on with our contractor. And as the deployments go, they send testing to the state, to my team, who verifies that things are working as they're intended to work. So if you change one thing in the system, you have to test that against every single kind of claim, every single co-location code, which is a financial code, that it can go to, and every type of provider, so that if we add a new service, only specific types of providers can be paid for that service for only specific recipients. So there's a lot of back and forth between my systems unit and the contractor to ensure that everything goes as needed. There is a huge deployment every single month. On several months, there's multiple deployments, such as I just got off the phone this morning. In March, there is a deployment every single weekend except for the first weekend in March. And so we just go through till those are completed, and then we don't just have one thing going at a time. Right now we have seven different projects going, and we have three different Senate Bill 74 initiatives that need changes.
Thank you, Director Brody. Briefly, if you could, when we met, you talked about interface in other areas of public health that Medicaid was participating in, because I was asking a question, how are we going to make sure Alaskans are healthy when we're always all focused on Medicaid and Medicaid recipients because it's the largest cost line. And so you had told me in a meeting that we had that I believe there were four other programs that intersected with Medicaid. And so again, from an organizational structure, briefly, are those folks helping with in your wheelhouse with changes to the system, or is that a portion of public health that is separated away from all hands on deck to meet the issues that we have?
Madam Chair, this is Margaret Brody. They don't help with the system. They help with population health type issues. And we try to align our policies as much as we can with public health. We work very closely with them.
Thank you. And Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So one of the other committees I sit on is Health and Social Services Committee. And yesterday we had a presentation from Behavioral Health that indicated that there's been some regulation change in autism services. And that around March and April of this year, we're going to be seeing an additional expenditure of about $9.8 million. When I pointed that out yesterday, I asked, is there going to be a federal match? And they said, yes, it's in fact 50-50 federal match. Okay, but that's still 50% for the state. And you did say anything over $100,000, we're going to try to get a 90% federal match. I'm concerned that we're going to be saving money with reforms, but it might be offset with expanded programs. What is the protocol to change regs to increase program costs to the state? Who has the authority to put the state on the financial hook to increase regulations, expand population, and increase programs? And with the state is still 50% or however many percent. This is news to us, and it bothered me all last night, and I have the opportunity to ask it today.
Deputy Commissioner Sherwood.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the Chair, Senator Von Inhofe. The addition of the autism regulations you referred to are, they're implementing a federal requirement. There was a federal clarification of policy that indicated that states, through their EPSDT program, their early periodic diagnosis or screening diagnosis and treatment programs, must provide coverage of these autism services for children until age 21. We are actually slow to implement that. We do get these federal policy clarifications or other federal changes we have to implement. We do that as part of our daily business. When those regulations get moved forward, they come up through the division responsible to the deputy commissioner or deputy commissioners in this case, because it's both Medicaid and behavioral health, and so that crosses between my duties and Deputy Commissioner Forrest's duties. So we vet the regulations ultimately before they go out. The commissioner is briefed and concurs. But this particular one is an implementation of a federal requirement. We're also in state litigation over the speed of which we've been implementing these regulations. They've been on our work plan for some time. And there are, you know, that is part of our state statute that we have to operate the Medicaid program in compliance with federal law and regulation. So in this particular case and in other cases like that, where it is a federal requirement, we look at how we're doing it. We look at whether we're doing it in the most cost-effective manner, but we move forward with it once we've determined that our approach is reasonable.
Senator Von Imhoff.
Okay, thank you. Two follow-up questions. Is there flexibility by how the state decides to implement it in terms of more robust or bare bones? And I did receive an email from a constituent who paid attention yesterday and indicated to ask me to ask you, where did you come up with the $9.8 million? And their concern was that it was going to actually cost quite a bit more. So those are the two questions.
Through the Chair, Senator Von Imhoff, I think the first question about is there flexibility, there is some flexibility in how we structure the program, but for EPSDT, we cannot put absolute limits on the amount of service. If it's medically necessary that an individual needs service, we must provide that service. We can, however, put in things like limits before going to a prior authorization or requiring some additional or special justification, and we do that. Let's see. I apologize because these regs are in the adoption process, so I have to stop and think about how specific I can be, but there are provisions around limits before you get to prior authorization or before you require prior authorization, I guess is a better way to say it. And the $9.8 million is, I would have to go back and refresh my memory exactly how we came up with that. We would look at number of children diagnosed. We'd also look at the number of providers available. So what our expectation of the services that would be available. You also mentioned earlier that there is a 50% federal match rate. That would apply for children who qualified under some categories of Medicaid, for instance, if they're eligible for our CHIP coverage, that would be 88%. If they receive those services through a tribal health facilities and they were an IHS beneficiary, then that would be at 100% federal. So there are varying match rates. The lowest match rate would that the federal government would pay would be 50%.
No further questions.
Director Sherwood, the only comment that I have is that at this table last year, during a discussion on your team's budget, we had folks call in from out of state to say to indicate that they had relocated their children, their family members to Alaska because of the robust system we have here for care. And so it appears, at least from a layman, that we have interpreted the mandates from the federal government in some regards higher than other places. And again, it's layman. I'm not into the policies. I do not know the fine details that you do when you pursue challenging the federal government in what we are required to do to maintain a program. But I just want to make sure that I put on the record are concerned that the federal government is driving $1 billion worth of spend just in your department alone. And most of it is specific to Medicaid. Whether it's the expanded numbers or not, I will stay away from that political difference. If you have any comments, please put them on the record, or otherwise I have others in mind to ask questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think Alaska has I would say it has a robust Medicaid program. It does offer services, and we have taken some options. I don't think we rank at the top. I think we're in the middle if you look at different states. Depending on your particular situation, Alaska may be more attractive than some other states. In other situations, we are not an attractive state. Lack of access to certain specialties, for instance. We also see families relocate out of Alaska because they want to be closer to the support for certain kinds of specialty care that aren't available here. And I think with regard to the federal requirements, as federal requirements come in, they are always challenging. But I also think that we always look at them and start with that sense of what can we do that gets the job done with the least impact to our program. That isn't always no impact or low impact, but we do look at our alternatives at how we can meet those requirements, and we don't necessarily go for the most fancy or sophisticated way if we do see that we have choices.
Director Sherwood, do you consider cost when you evaluate those programs to the state, or do you only consider the public health portion of the program?
Madam Chair, I consider cost, certainly. Obviously, the health is important, and we want to do things that provide us with good health outcomes, but we also are aware that with any particular choice, if we're going to spend money in one area, it's money we may not be able to spend in another area that also provides benefits. So we're always looking about how we're allocating our resources and deciding where we're going to get the most benefit. But again, as I mentioned before, we are sometimes constrained by federal requirements about how we operate the program.
Senator Stevens.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. I really appreciate the discussion and where it's gone. And I realize our primary concern here is cost savings. But Ms. Brody mentioned an issue that I think is extremely important, and that's the patient knowing what their costs have been. And I think often even those of us probably in this room is covered under insurance, and I have no idea what prescriptions or medical procedures cost for me, for example. So if we really expect people to change their behavior, we really have to let them know what those costs are. So you mentioned that it's a process you're looking at, and that certainly it seems to me that needs to be easily understood. Anybody should be able to look at what their costs have been and understand what they were for. When is this going to happen? And I hope it's not going to be too long in the future.
Director Brody.
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, this is Margaret Brody. I beat our contractor up on this every single Thursday morning from 8 a.m. to 9 a.m. And I can't remember if we have a specific date yet, but it will be happening sometime in the next 6 to 7 months. And feel free to listen into these conversations, because it's a huge thing with me, because we promised we would do that, and here we are literally 2 years later, and our recipients aren't receiving this, and I try to uphold everything that we promised to do.
Thank you, Senator Stevens. Follow up.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Madam Chair, I appreciate that response. I just think we just cannot leave the patient in the dark about this. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Machicki.
I have to admit, if I were giving a recommendation, it would be to not expand in any new area until we get a handle on costs. I'm surprised that we're even thinking about it, and what I could say is we've underestimated in almost every category and in some cases dramatically. I just don't see how we can be looking at expanding in any new area until we get a handle on what we're spending. Question I have is, have you considered a private sector insurance manager into the department? I can tell you that when I think about having my family go to a physician for anything, and I remember the months it takes for it to settle, the battles that go back and forth on making sure costs are as low as possible, we think about it. And our family, and I knock on wood and pray every morning that our family's health continues. We're a very healthy family, and I realize not everyone has that benefit. But without that pressure, sort of a private sector consideration of what things cost, I would estimate that these averages in each category of age for a per capita cost is substantially higher than private sector insurance costs. All in. These are utilization. Utilization. These are actual costs. This is actual spending. I'm just wondering if that's something we've, unfortunately, sometimes a shark amongst all of you folks with really big hearts that I appreciate is a really important mix. Is that something you've considered?
Director Sherwood.
Through the chair, Senator Machicki, it's certainly something we look at from time to time. I think it's also important to realize that the Medicaid program is different from health insurance in several ways, one of which is it includes a long-term services and supports benefit package that is not common to most insurance program. That's about, I think right now it's about a quarter of our spending are in those areas. Other parts of it is the federal restrictions on cost sharing. The populations, I think, especially when you look at populations break out by age, you need to remember that that looks at breakouts that would include people with disabilities, people who are on our program because they are essentially by definition in worse health than other people. So that is going to drive up our costs. There are trying to remember whether I mentioned the appeal rights, the fair hearing appeal rights, which are more substantial than what you have under most private insurance entities. So all of those things still need to be managed and need to be provided, as well as the EPSDT services. When you look at states going to sort of pure private insurance models for Medicaid, they usually have to have some kind of wraparound to do the long-term services and supports and the EPS meet the full EPSDT requirements because those aren't in commercial products. So we have those discussions. I think that's part of the discussion that's going on right now around the healthcare authority between multiple departments, not just ours. As we look at that, one of the things we're looking at are the efficiencies that you might gain by sort of pooling your talent across the different ways we pay for healthcare, and what the best way to get those efficiencies are. I think it's probably fair to say that if you look at that process, because Medicaid has really different constraints, it's seen as not the place to start. It's sort of pull that in as you pool some of the other healthcare payment sources. But we do consider that would, if we were to ever go that way, that would be a fairly substantial transition we would have to manage. And we'd have to do that at the same time we're continuing to manage these changes ongoing. So I think that's maybe a long-winded answer to sort of sum up where we stand right now.
Senator Machicki, follow up.
I'm okay, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Deputy Commissioner Sherwood, thank you. I believe I called you director because I'm looking at Margaret Brody. Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you. Just to build upon Senator Machicki's comment, have you thought about at least putting out an RFP, and not necessarily for the entire Medicaid, because I think that's a big nut, but maybe one component just to start small and to see what kind of responses that you get from the private sector? And while the private sector may not have the in-depth understanding that you just described about the complexity of your population, you might be surprised about what they do understand and what their capabilities are, and they actually might bring things to the table that you don't have. And I think an RFP process, small or a small component, is worthwhile to consider, and let's just see what kind of comes up with it.
Through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, I apologize because I think I was remiss in my last answer. I really, thinking about it globally, I overlooked the obvious, which is in our coordinated care demonstration projects, one of the options to propose was the managed care organization at the demonstration level, exactly as you're discussing. And we are in negotiations with three different entities, and I think I'm allowed to say in that process that one of them is a managed care organization. So in terms of exploring the potential to move in that direction in a smaller way. We are in the process of doing that right now.
Follow up, Senator Von Imhoff.
And that's for eligibility processing potentially and payment processing, is that correct?
Through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, it's not for eligibility determination. I need to be clear. That can only be done for Medicaid under federal law by government employees who are merit-based employees or by employees of tribally operated TANF programs. There is no, you can't contract out Medicaid eligibility determination. We can contract out operation of eligibility systems. Right now, our eligibility systems are operated by the state, but that is a possibility for the future. What we're looking at in terms of a managed care organization would really be the claims payment, the coverage side of it, not the eligibility side of it. Certainly, there has to be an interface with eligibility for them to do their work, but they would not take on eligibility duties.
Thank you, Deputy Commissioner Sherwood. With that, if we could return to the slides. At the end, I'll be asking a question on waivers. Citizens have contacted me, and I've heard at a variety of places of concern that all of the waivers are actually driving costs, and if the legislature would just eliminate all the waivers, we could save upwards of $200 million. And so, if you could think about that, I don't want a detailed description, but I would like to, if we have the time to talk about that. I have asked our Health and Social Services Committee to look at the waivers so the public has an opportunity to see how the department is deploying waivers, why, and what would happen if we ceased to have those waivers there. And there's a variety of issues inside of that conversation. Ms. Martin, slide 18, or are we ready to move to 19?
Thank you, Madam Chair. We're ready to move on to slide 19. This relates to fraud and abuse prevention provisions in SB 74. And though we see that this initiative is a bit delayed, I would like to just state that we do have a very robust fraud, abuse, and waste prevention program already at the Department of Health and Social Services and also located in the Department of Law. And Department of Law, sort of jumping to the bottom of this slide, produces an annual report on fraud, waste, and abuse prevention efforts in the state of Alaska based on fiscal year. That report is transmitted to the legislature on November 15 of each year. And in that report highlights some of the larger fraud cases, some of which you may have read about in the newspaper, and efforts to reclaim those state dollars. But these provisions in SB 74 helped us set up the Alaska Medicaid False Claims and Reporting Act. And this would help us achieve an enhanced FMAP. And at the federal level, we continue coordination with the Office of Inspector General through the Department of Law and the Department of Health and Social Services. We have some challenges there. We are trying to work through them with the Office of Inspector General. But earlier was raised potential opportunities where we could come back to the legislature for help, and this might be one of those areas in the future, so we will continue to keep you apprised of this one. Our efforts continue to identify fraud, waste, and abuse. We have saved money, and the report outlines that specific to the False Claims and Reporting Act. However, there was another provision in there requiring audits to perform self-audits to identify overpayments and return those to the state. And recently, just last week, the department signed off on some regulations, and those have been transmitted to the Department of Law. So while we might be delayed as we ramp up this program in FY18 and really get it going in FY19, we will still be able to achieve some of those savings. Merely having these False Claims and Reporting Act included in SB 74 in this audit does help us. There were a couple of trainings throughout the state of Alaska back in calendar year 16 and 17 to help providers understand these new auditing and fraud, waste, and abuse preventions so that they would better understand. So we believe we're achieving savings merely by having these on the books, though those are harder to quantify for the legislature.
Ms. Martin, do we have something like Crime Stoppers, a phone line that offers $1,000 for a tip that actually is something that we go after and it is a fraud? Is there something like Crime Stoppers in the state for this?
Madam Chair, there are a couple of phone calls that we've got when I reviewed that fraud, waste, and abuse report. Some are identified to the department as folks see something that doesn't look quite right, and they call and let us know. We don't have funding for that, but we do take those calls. We have a program integrity unit in the Department of Health and Social Services, and then the Medicaid Fraud Control Unit located in the Department of Law. There's also some, getting back to data analytics and the importance of that, we have a contractor that helps do some utilization reviews and helps us identify odd things, odd maybe in how a provider is billing or that don't quite match up with federal regulations. And then we have a unit that then sort of dives into the claims and looks at, are the claims really sort of matching up with a potential Medicaid recipient's health condition? So that sometimes it's merely a training issue with a provider's billing office or staff providing care. Some of those, when we feel like it is fraud, they are then transmitted to the Medicaid Fraud Control Unit for additional investigation.
Thank you, Ms. Martin, or abuse prevention. Senator Stevens?
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. So it's not enough if we know. I mean, we have to, the public has to know, and I know that you can't name names and that sort of thing, but if you're going to stop that bad behavior, the public has to be aware that people are actually being caught and prosecuted for illegal activity. So how does the public learn about this?
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, we work with our Medicaid Fraud Control Unit. Oftentimes there's press releases that are distributed when we're at a point in an investigation where we can publicly disclose that information. And that fraud report outlines several cases that were in the news that you might recognize when you read the name and be like, I remember reading about that in the newspaper or seeing it on the news. So it is something that we like to publicize to deter potential bad practices from other individuals, either on the recipient side or the provider side.
Thank you.
Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you. One of the things I noticed here, require Medicaid providers to conduct self-audits and return overpayments. What about potentially third-party surprise audits? I know in the banking industry we have surprise audits that come in once a year.
Through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, we do, in addition to self-audits, we do regular audits of our providers. We every year we come up with a sample of providers to audit, and we do audits. We look to audit across all different provider types in various areas of the state. In addition to our efforts, there are also federal efforts that come in. There is the PERM for payment error rate measurement that does selective sampling of our state claims, and then goes down and drills down at the provider level to look at practices. There are also Office of Inspector General audits. And probably two or three other kinds of audits that I'm forgetting off the top of my head. One of the things we get complaints about from our providers is the number of audits. And in our audits, generally speaking, for the random audits, we wouldn't audit the same provider more than once every 3 years, partly because that's about how long it takes to get through the cycle. So we would still have an audit in process while we were starting the second audit. But between our audits and the federal government audits, we would, there is a high level of auditing going on, and I think I would also just say, any time we see something suspicious, that does not prevent us from going in and doing a separate investigation or audit as appropriate.
Madam Chair. Thank you, Deputy Commissioner Sherwood. Senator Von Imhoff.
What have you found in these audits the last couple years? Can you summarize the results?
Through the Chair, Senator Von Imhoff, I would say that we find a combination of things. We find that many of our providers are billing appropriately. They have some small degree of errors. And then we find situations where people are billing inappropriately, either through lack of education about our policies, or in some cases it appears to be fraudulent, in which case we will turn it over for further criminal investigation.
Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you. So in the last few years, you have conducted these audits and you have found some material results, yet I see this actuals for 2017, zero.
Senator Von Imhoff, that really has to, through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, that really has to do with what we put in the fiscal note and where we expected to see revenues. That, I believe, was our projections for what we would obtain through, if I'm remembering correctly in the fiscal note, through the creating the State False Claims Act, and we have not yet gotten approval from the Office of Inspector General that our State False Claims Act qualifies. That does not indicate the level of recoveries we do through audits annually. We can get you that information. But that's very specific to implementing a particular provision of the fiscal note.
Thank you. And with that, I'd ask committee members for your support in trying to advance through a few slides so that we can wrap up this conversation on Medicaid. We will have additional questions that we can ask the subcommittee to take a further look at that may not be as as transparent as on this table with a camera rolling so that we can cover it. But subcommittee processes are recorded, I believe. So please, let's go forward. Ms. Martin, slide 19. We were on fraud and abuse.
Madam Chair, for those listening at home, if I could just provide one of my lifelines in the back of the room provided the message line for fraud. If residents are watching and they're a little bit concerned, they can call us at 907-269-6279, and there's a message hotline. They can remain confidential and provide information so that we can delve into those issues.
Thank you. Are we reaching out to the pharmacists in our state with an opioid epidemic? The pharmacists are the front line of actual distribution of prescription drugs. Do we reach out to those individuals for reporting?
Madam Chair, one of the provisions related to the prescription drug monitoring program, which was really important for the department, was allowing the Medicaid pharmacists access to the data in the prescription drug monitoring program. And that's been very helpful for us in fighting the opioid epidemic because we can also identify individuals that are perhaps not using their Medicaid benefit to purchase those opioids, trying to fly under the radar a little bit. And it really allows our Medicaid pharmacists to get into that data and track Alaskans because they might not want to use that benefit for fear of being tracked. Now our Medicaid pharmacists can get in there and find who's not using their benefits to get a hold of prescription drugs inappropriately.
Please continue.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Moving to slide 20, the electronic verification system is a third-party verification system to determine making sure that Alaskans are eligible for our Medicaid program and sort of reviewing their information to ensure that what they provided on their application and to the department is factual and accurate. Specific to SB 74, the bill called out that the annual savings from this program must exceed the annual cost. And we hit a delay related to some of our software system. Our eligibility technicians at the Division of Public Assistance operate in two systems currently, EIS, the Eligibility Information System, and ARES, Alaska's Resource for Integrated Enrollment Services. And we were on the verge of transitioning to ARES 2, an update that would allow our eligibility technicians to work in one system. And in that system, upgrade was going to be the EVS, the Eligibility Verification System. Unfortunately, we had a parting of the ways with that contractor, and the department took on maintenance of the first release of ARES in January of 2017. I will say that we have been able to successfully keep that system up and running. We reached out then to our partners at CMS, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, and said, hey, we need some help. They've paid for a significant portion of the system to date. And they deployed their 18F team, which is sort of a federal team of computer folks that help you work through these system issues. And they've been really helping us with an agile development process that allows us to implement upgrades to different pieces of the system instead of waiting for one big whole rollout to ARES 2. So knowing that that was a requirement of SB 74 to implement the EVS, the Eligibility Verification System, we have been working with them for that agile development process to roll it into an asset verification system, an AVS, that's required for by the federal government for Medicaid recipients who are aged or disabled. So we are going to roll those two contracts together. We have been working with procurement, CMS, the department, and plan to release that RFP for both systems by the end of April of this current year.
Thank you. At some point, if you could highlight, it doesn't need to be now, the asset portion of that conversation. As I understand it, the federal government did change some requirements on Medicaid, and assets now cannot be used for eligibility determination, which was not the case when we actually passed SB 74. Am I getting that wrong? I'm just remembering that some people can qualify to receive the benefit now, regardless of the total value of their assets. If I'm not getting it right, let's get it on the record correctly. Deputy Commissioner Sherwood.
Madam Chair, thank you. You are correct that some Medicaid recipients are not subject to an asset test, and in eligibility parlance, they're called resources, but most of us think of them as assets. So. And those are your children, your low-income parents and caretaker relatives, pregnant women, and your Medicaid expansion population. The Medicaid categories for the aged and blind and disabled all still have asset tests. These are categories that typically serve people for long periods of time, if not life. People are on the program for the duration, the federal government still has asset tests for those categories, and those are the categories that we're required to do the asset verification for.
Thank you for that clarification. Ms. Martin, please continue.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, again, this is Monique Martin. We're moving to slide 21. And we wanted to touch on some of the Medicaid expansion matches, because it's a little bit of overlapping state fiscal year with calendar year, and we discussed previously the impact of the expenditures for IHS recipients who are also Medicaid recipients at tribal health facilities or with that referral process we talked about. So as you start to see the calendar year FMAP, the federal match for Medicaid expansion, and then we overlaid that and did an analysis of when we overlay that calendar year FMAP with the state fiscal year and then take into account those expenditures that qualify regardless of the federal match for 100% reimbursement from the federal government. This starts to give you an idea of our federal mat, or excuse me, our state GF portion related to Medicaid expansion. We wanted to touch a little bit on that since we talked about the supplemental and thought this might help paint a bit of a clearer picture of how we got that information.
Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you for this. Is there any way that you can overlay actual dollar values with your estimate dollar values? So I see in fiscal year 20, 5.53%. What is that going to yield in actual money so we can plan?
Ms. Martin.
Madam Chair, through the Chair, Senator Von Imhoff, moving to slide 22, I can give you a little bit of a breakdown. This match gives you the GF match, and we can do the math, but I'd be happy to give you not only the dollar amounts, but how we came up with that dollar amount that we anticipated in the GFs, or the total spend, excuse me, for the expansion population, and thereby how we got the GF portion.
I appreciate that. I do see slide 22. When I asked this question, I did see that slide, and it's these. You're telling us similar yet not quite apples to apples, and so if you could flesh this out with a little bit more of a GF spend, that would be great.
Through the Chair, Senator Von Imhoff, we can absolutely get you that information, not a problem. For those following at home, my apologies, it is a big, busy spreadsheet, but you can see in that second to last column, or row, pardon me, you can move across and see the GF spend that are actual for FY17 and then our projections moving into 18 and 19. And then to give a little bit clearer picture, we've identified areas where we've been able to take general fund reductions, not only in the Department of Health and Social Services, but at the Department of Corrections. Moving to slide 23, one of the other issues we've talked a little bit about is Medicaid expansion enrollment. And what are we experiencing? And not unlike other states that expanded Medicaid before the state of Alaska through administrative order, you'll see that in as we got to year two, which was September of 2017, we really started to see those enrollment growth. So this is our growth rate from month to month. We really started to see that level out. So we feel like we are right on track, that we are over in our enrollment that we anticipated. I think that we are seeing the level off like other states experienced after about 24 months. Moving to slide 24, one of the questions that we were asked to prepare for in advance of this meeting are not only the cost-saving measures that the department has implemented related to SB 74, but some of our other efforts. And we are, my apologies on slide 24 for those who are potentially following at home. And this outlines some of our actual savings for FY 17 and our estimates for FY 18. And as we move sort of towards the middle of that page, you can see some of the initiatives that we implemented for FY 18 when we identified the potential over for the Medicaid program. And Director Brody and Director Mays have some detailed information, if you would like that, Madam Chair, on how we've been able to, are we on target with our savings that we identified through reducing provider rates or through reducing dayhab hours?
Director Brody.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is Margaret Brody from Healthcare Services. And we actually exceeded our projections for savings due to the decrease in rates for hospitals and for physicians by $3 million.
Dr. Brody, we appreciate that. Can you share for the people of Alaska, repeat why we have $100 million worth of add in the base of the budget for Medicaid? I think the more correct answer is 93 now, even though that might be different. For the increased spending, if we've just help the public understand.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We've had a large increase in the enrollment of individuals, which have driven up the cost for the basic care for the individuals. So the hospital services, the physician services, and the pharmacy have grown. And in addition, for the past 2 years, we've had a lot of growth in pharmacy with the hepatitis C drugs and other specialty drugs. And new drugs are coming out at unprecedented costs, not only to the Medicaid programs, but to all health payers. And so we've done a lot of work in trying to decrease those costs. We've been working on a national level with every other state, trying to curb those costs and slow them down. So we have all these savings, but it still is an increase in the overall cost. So if we didn't have these savings, what we would have been asking for would be almost twice as much as what we did ask for this year.
Thank you, Director Brody. I know it wasn't yesterday. I believe it was the day before when Senator Hoffman had the gavel and we had the department before us. Does anyone at the microphones this morning have the numbers for the people of Alaska on the growth of population? So I'm recalling, and probably inaccurately, that we're estimating 240,000 recipients of Medicaid in FY19's budget, and that is up from I just don't recall the numbers, and I don't see it. I can't lay my fingers on it right here, but I know that we had 3 years of growth. Ms. Martin, do you have that?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I might not be able to give us an apples to apples comparison on that number. The 215,000 was the unduplicated count. Those are potential Alaskans that were receiving Medicaid benefits and could have had received the services through the program. I do have some numbers. If we look at FY16 compared to FY17, one of the tools we use is an average of monthly enrollment for the Medicaid program. It helps to take out some of those seasonal swings that we have in our Medicaid enrollment, and also folks that maybe are just on the program for a brief period of time if they are transitioning between jobs or other factors. So in FY16, our average of monthly total Medicaid enrollment was 151,409. Moving to 17, that average monthly enrollment was 186,748 for state fiscal year 17.
Could you repeat that number for the 2017?
Yes. Madam Chair, it was 186,748.
Thank you. Are we paying out then 30,000 claims per week or per month? There was some other information provided to this committee 2 years ago regarding payment. I think we were talking about the payments out, and the number was 30,000, but it could have been per week. Ms. Brody, I can take that offline to find out that answer. Do you have any comment on that?
Madam Chair, we pay over 120,000 claims per week for an average of $35
million. $35 million. Thank you. Senator Michiki.
So I've asked a lot of questions on kind of the healthy adult range of folks who are covering on Medicaid. I have two questions. One is, in my view, the folks, the program should be designed to assist those that are most in need. Now, I'm wondering why a target was on the folks that required day habitation services versus healthy adults that happen to be on the program. I believe that we could more heavily manage healthy individuals on the program to prevent overutilization versus reducing day habitation services for those Alaskans that really do not have a choice and that do need those services.
Through the chair, Senator Michiki, I think rather than trying to answer to the general level, I'd like to bring Director Mays to the table, Duane Mays, with Senior and Disability Services, to discuss why day habilitation was a focal point.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Duane Mays. I'm the director for the Division of Senior and Disability Services. I think I'll start first by just providing you a definition of what day habilitation is. So it's taking an individual that is on the waiver, the developmental disability waiver, out into the community and engaging them in the variety of activities that often occur within that community, whether it's going to the bank or going to a medical appointment. So it's all about active instruction. It's teaching the individual the skills that they need in order to be as independent as possible. Now, they may not have, they may not be able to be entirely independent, but that's the goal of debilitation, with the intent that you also look at natural supports. So over the years, I believed as a division director, I saw significant growth in cost to debilitation. So in my 7.5 years, I would say in the last 5 years, it's grown by about 40%+. So that was of concern. When we looked at the use of debilitation, the average amount is about 11 hours a week. So I believe that we need to identify other types of services that are more appropriate than just day habilitation, its entire package. So when you're getting 30 to 40 hours requests per week, I believe that is pretty excessive. So I do have some numbers here just to kind of give you a snapshot of where we're at. So we went live with debilitation, the cap on October 1 of this year. So we have reviewed 744 plans of care to date that have come in after the 1st of October. We have denied about 8% of those because they were above the cap. And that's 98 that we've done. Of that, it's a total of about 27,000 hours that we have denied since October 1. There have been three plans of care where they provide good justification for hours above 12 a week. So it's not a hard cap. It is a soft cap, but they have to provide significant justification as to why. Are they at risk of institutionalization is the key. So three, we've had 11 fair hearing requests, or excuse me, 15 fair hearing requests. We have heard on three. We have heard on one of those decisions, and it's favorable to the division. So this was not something that we just did randomly. We really put a lot of thought into making sure that we were right-sizing that service category.
Madam Chair, if I may.
Senator Michiki.
The administration's cut was from 15 to 8. I increased it to 12 because I thought the cut was unacceptable. So you were cutting well below average. But in comparison to that 40% increase in cost, Medicaid itself has increased at a faster rate. I'm wondering why, in our prioritization, we're not looking at managing healthy adults' health care versus those that are most in need. I mean, we all know some of these folks, and I don't feel that that's a service that is abused. I'm sure there's some potential, but you're looking at a minor proportion of cost versus the potential savings if we prioritize reducing utilization in the healthy populations that aren't in need. And I know where your heart is. I mean, these are tough times. I just struggle with that. It seems like we're not putting the attention in the places where you can get the greatest bang for the state in reductions. And yet some of these families that struggle every day, some extremely amazing human beings that have jobs and are kind of beating all the odds and doing some amazing things in Alaska. It seems like our prioritization could be reevaluated.
Thank you for those comments. Thank you, Mr. Mays. Continuing on, we're on slide 24. Is there any further questions on slide 24? Again, I'd like to say on behalf of the committee that we appreciate the department, both the public health side and those that are working in the Medicaid side to deliver services to some of Alaska's most needy folks. We've said this before. Senator Hoffman has been very clear. Committee members are very clear that the state continues to face declined revenue, and our ability to make payments that are in the billions of dollars is drawing money from savings accounts versus managing within the means that we have. So I wanted to extend again a thank you to you and your team. Commissioner Davidson has been here the entire time for both days. I want to thank you for being here and thank you for all that you do for Alaskans and the information that you provide timely to those in the legislature that are requesting information to know more about the services that you provide. The information sheet that Senator Michiki was referring to was the 2017 numbers that we requested yesterday. So I appreciate that. It lended to a valuable interaction today about cost of those services. Closing comments from committee members or questions for the department? Seeing and hearing none, tomorrow, February 2nd at 9 a.m., Senate Finance will meet and hear Senate Bill 4, non-chemical barbering. With that, we're adjourned.